Good evening, everybody, and a very warm welcome to this lecture, indeed this inaugural lecture, in a series on Atlantic slavery and its aftermaths, being sponsored by All Souls College. My name is John Vickers. I'm the warden of the college. My subject is economics. And before introducing our speaker, please allow me to say a few words about some measures which the college has decided to take in recent years to recognize and to address the fact that the college library, which was built 300 years ago approximately, the funds for that largely came from a legacy, £10,000 in money of the day, from Christopher Codrington, former fellow of the college, whose family wealth largely derived from sugar plantations in Barbados and and elsewhere in the Caribbean. And of course, those plantations were worked by slaves. The measures that the college is taking come under two headings. One is memorialization, and the second is academic initiatives. So first, on memorialization. 5 years ago, a memorial plaque was placed at the Cat Street entrance to the library. Many of you will have seen that, if you've gone into the library because it's the main route in, or just passing by on Cat Street. And that plaque is in memory of those who worked in slavery on the Codrington plantations in the West Indies. That was 5 years ago when we embarked on some of our academic initiatives too. In the library itself, this is more recent, and the college no longer refers to the library as the Codrington, which was how it was known for a couple of hundred years. We now project onto the statue of Codrington, which is at the center of the library, the names of enslaved persons who worked on those plantations in the early 18th century. That's now projected along with other related images onto the statue of Codrington. And in the anteroom to the library through which all readers pass, there are digital displays, there are four screens on the history and on other relevant matters. And we are working through historical research to try and enrich the historical information and historical understanding to inform what is on those displays and what is projected onto the statue. So that, in summary, there are other measures too, but in summary, those are some of the main measures of memorialization. On the academic front, we are doing the following. 5 years ago, we established three fully funded graduate scholarships at Oxford for students from the Caribbean. Those are named after Sir Hugh Springer. They're known as the Springer Scholarships. And Sir Hugh was a visiting fellow at the college in the early 60s. So that's 60 years ago. And as many of you will know, he later went on to be the Governor General of Barbados. And his portrait hangs in our hall. For British students, UK students, of black or mixed black ethnicity, the college has made a donation of £1 million over 10 years to the fairly new university program on black academic futures. So that's, we think, a very important academic initiative of the university that we, as a college, very much want to support. We have also, and this has been true for decades, have supported Codrington College in Barbados. That is a theological college which was also founded with funds from the will of Christopher Codrington. Moreover, and the following is work in progress, it got delayed because of the pandemic, and we would very much value suggestions on how we can take this forward most effectively. We are very keen to launch and develop and strengthen a program of visiting fellowships and travel grants to enable researchers from the Caribbean to come to Oxford. So that is another of the academic initiatives which in recent years we have decided to undertake. Finally, we have established this lecture series, and this evening is the inaugural occasion of that series. And we are absolutely delighted and extremely grateful that Professor Paul Gilroy has agreed to give this lecture. As I'm sure all who know him would agree, there could be no better person to inaugurate this series of lectures. Both as an intellectual historian and as a cultural commentator, he will be known to many of you for his work on the politics of race and racism and on the cultural lives of the African diaspora. At UCL, he is Professor of the Humanities and Founding Director of the Sarah Parker Riemann Center for the Study of Racism and Racialization. And his immensely distinguished career before the recent period at UCL includes time teaching at South Bank Polytechnic, Essex, Yale, the LSE, and King's College in London. Among his many honours, he's a Fellow of the British Academy and the Royal Society of Literature and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and 4 years ago was awarded the Holberg Prize. The title of this evening's lecture, as you see, is Race Thinking and the Half-Life of Atlantic Slavery. And let us together thank you so much for giving this first lecture in our series. Thank you.
Thank you, John, for such a warm and important introduction. And before I start, I wish to express my own personal thanks for the opportunity you've given me to participate in this important reparative exercise. I would like this lecture to be heard as a plea. First, that we adjust our understanding of what is intellectually valuable in scholarship directed against racism and the contemporary effects of racial hierarchy. Second, that we develop a greater appreciation of work that delves systematically into the history of attachment to the idea of race, work which explores the fluctuating appeal of racist ideas and the functioning of quietly racialized institutions. None of those tasks can be dissociated from the disavowed but continuing impact of Atlantic slavery in this country and beyond. Those efforts necessitate a kind of counter-history, a counter-history that supplies resources with which to understand contemporary political culture, and they also underscore the value of a tradition of radical Black Atlantic thought, which in the modern epoch has repeatedly been defined precisely through the salience of raciology's puzzles to its evolving operation. Some decades ago, Henry Louis Gates spoke for all affiliates of that partisan project when he pronounced race, and I'm quoting, the ultimate trope of difference. And today, the ontopolitical alchemy of race and recognition and rights, to borrow a thought from Patricia Williams, points to all the accumulated, useless violence of the so-called Windrush scandal and demands to be understood because its recurrence connects Britain's bloody colonial and imperial past to our uncomfortably post- and neo-colonial present, as well as to the resurgence of racism and its violent entanglements with ultranationalism and neo-fascism elsewhere. A note of caution emerges immediately into these endeavours. From the seldom-remembered writing of Cornelius Castoriadis, celebrated philosopher, economist, and psychoanalyst, co-author of Facing Reality, the New Society, Where to Look for It and How to Bring it Closer, with his sometime comrades, the autodidact revolutionary historian C.L.R. James and the peerless activist from Chicago, Grace Lee Boggs. Prepared in the wake of the Hungarian uprising of 1956, their collaboration was a short volume on the transformed conditions for socialist politics. Thinking about the racial order of the Cold War USA had refined Castoriadis' understanding of the formation of racialized individual subjects within what he called a social imaginary. And as he moved away from the influence of Marx, Castoriadis began to argue that though material factors would always in some sense be primary, the deepest sources of racial feeling in human beings derived from psychosocial dispositions, particularly mechanisms of self-loathing, contorted so that they could be projected outwards into the world. Let me quote him. "Self-hatred is a component of every human being, and like all the rest, the object of an uninterrupted psychical elaboration. I think that it is this self-hatred, the hatred of self, usually intolerable under its overt form for obvious reasons, that nourishes the most driven forms of the hatred of the other and is discharged in its cruelest and most archaic manifestations," unquote. Well, in my academic generation, the political movement against racisms in the world was unsettled by speculations of that type. And combative alternatives often centered, sometimes reductively, on concepts of exploitation and oppression and extraction were widely taken up. Comprehending the historical and the economic and political dynamics of racial hierarchy in relation to its cultural and its psychosocial aspects was extremely difficult. And until Frantz Fanon's decentering of racial subjects had been better understood, attempts at what he called sociogenetic analysis were considered marginal, much more in tune with liberal and sentimental and religious sensibilities than anything to do with the kind of maverick left which shaped what would come to be known as anti-racism. In Britain, that late 20th century struggle frequently relied upon insights produced by anti-colonial incomers who had settled during the 1950s and 60s. Their analysis identified an intermediate space of antagonism between the subjective and the structural, directing attention towards political mobilization and the conflict of ideas. And the most influential of these figures was Stuart Hall, formed in the Caribbean, the paradigmatic space of colonial modernity. When I went to Birmingham in 1978 as a PhD student, I had his voice ringing in my ears, and he just told a sizable BBC television audience that Britain's black and brown citizenry were, and I'm quoting him, "the sugar you stir, the tea leaves at the bottom of the famous British cuppa." And even as the tea bags began to outsell loose tea, that rhetoric pointed slyly at intractable problems of misrecognition and thwarted belonging, identifying a strange, racially warranted mixture of exclusion and confinement, the problem of being inside, yet not fully of. So Hall spoke for the unhomely post-colonial denizens of this country, people who are not to be accommodated where they were. He also spoke to bona fide Englanders estranged from the history they needed to learn and to process if the country was to free itself from the trammels of empire and create a better democracy less invested in the inherited conceits of racial rule. Perhaps Hall's teacup derives obliquely from George Orwell's insights into the cultural significance of drinking tea, and making tea, actually. It dramatized the intertwined fates of laboring classes at home and abroad, and their discrepant histories were distilled in the liquid ritual that illustrated the hybridizing patterns common to all colonial cultures, and peculiarly composed the nation's cozy image of itself. And Hall prompted acknowledgement of the superfluous life condensed into the sweetness and those leftover soggy leaves. His provocation sought modifications to the common sense of England. He invited new awareness of a revised colonial history in reforming and repairing the kind of country decolonization and black settlement would bring into being. The teacup, the sugar, and the leaves raised the question of what scale was most appropriate for constructing those narratives, what intellectual, ethical, and cultural character they should have. How might the salvaged lives of blacks and other others during and after Britain's formal decolonization and its continuing Americanization alter the capacity to imagine not the country's past, but its likely future? Those lines of inquiry mattered because Britain's common sense racism was so tightly interwoven with its nationalism. And conflict around race impinged upon the hypersensitive core of national self-understanding. And that reaction was amplified by a deficit of historical information, which, when combined with the certainties of what I like to call groomed ignorance, encouraged pathological configurations of cultural identity, identifiable through that incorrigible attachment to the race idea. Postcolonial countries prefer to avoid the shocks that arrive with fuller appreciation of the violence and the cruelty that formed them, and, once upon a time, made them planetarily powerful. As a result, reckoning with imperial history gets avoided. It can be deeply repressed, or, as we see so often in the sports arenas, diverted into a kind of manic patriotic affirmation. In those conditions, the Creole future that awaits us, and it does await us, appears only as a source of fear and anxiety. Is it necessary today, this evening, to say that this racial nationalism is still pending in the chronic crisis around this country's relationship with the EU? That it squats amidst the transformation of our major political parties into populist vectors for know-nothing English nativism? That it's helped to rewire the machinery of political communication for a dangerous period defined by the growing significance of functional illiteracy and the potency of timeline media? Overt racist messaging on immigration, on culture, on heritage, combined with sock puppeting, the diversity and inclusion of the government's minority affiliates, has so far proved to be an important aspect of pulling a new electoral bloc together. And securing it, as we see day by day, drip after drip, requires maintaining xenophobic commentary and authoritarian ultranationalism at a high temperature. Searching the symptomatology of England's chronic post-colonial ailments, we can observe that the drift into this particular pattern began with Enoch Powell's April 1968 speech against the Labour government's Race Relations Act. His opposition to anti-discrimination law initiated the historic conjuncture in which Britain seems to have become politically stuck. Put aside the fact that Powell's contemporary fandom, and they are out there, seems positively disappointed by the relative absence of those rivers of blood he had foreseen, his speech began with this fearful prediction, I want to remind you of, recycled by the great statesman from a constituent whose offspring were fleeing the country. If the horrible issues of immigration and cultural difference are not addressed, he says, in 15 or 20 years, and I'm quoting now, the black man will have the whip hand over the white man in Britain. Well, it didn't happen. Certainly the appeal of that idiom of political speech cannot be understood without acknowledging the pressures exerted by the latent memories and imaginative residues of the Atlantic trade in slaves. That's what the image does for him. To its political unconscious, if you like, a formation which is still present, though happily by no means dominant in contemporary culture and society. Well, since the American summer of 2020, the term decolonization has provided a way to express desire for institutional changes. It's an approximation rather than a precise way to identify how we can work through the melancholic residues of Britain's vanished imperial and colonial preeminence. To my ear, that prefix, decolonization, suggests that the character of the effort is considered too simple, that the volatile traces of the colonial order beneath post and neocolonial minefields are easy to find and to remove, and that those critical and creative exercises are essentially a matter of subtraction rather than of any potential gains. It's clear from John's opening remarks that this college's efforts to come to terms with its unique colonial connections suggest an appreciation of the additive possibilities here. And that explicitly reparative work, like the Trevelyan family's recent public apology to the people of Grenada, confirms a more general and a more difficult lesson. The aftershocks of Atlantic racial slavery are like the ecological loss and damage that began with the movement of animals and plants and pests and pathogens associated with colonial conquest and commerce. It is an ongoing political problem. Those aftershocks rumble on. So reparation is fundamental to the future that we share, and as Mia Mottley's Barbados government has demonstrated recently, the need for a new settlement is intensified by the unevenly distributed effects of the climate crisis, as well as the imperially skewed responsibility for it. These adjustments of perspective invite related propositions that may be a little bit more difficult to entertain. First, that the reverberations of the Atlantic trade in slaves acquired additional energy, further echoes from later expressions of race thinking that they had fostered. And second, that the feedback loops and unanticipated accumulations can be detected even now in the activities of racist, ultranationalist, and xenophobic groupings. For me, it's a powerful presence in the image of this cleansing expulsion of aliens to Rwanda, of all places. So for all the advanced technological capabilities involved in these racist and ultranationalist movements, they do tend to recycle the power-light images of invasive war and cleansing expulsion in order to orchestrate the restoration of departed greatness, to promote national and racial rebirth, thereby extending the old playbook of 20th century fascist movements. Still, mapping these repetitions and convergences is an indispensable practice, not just for improved scholastic understanding of race thinking and racially infused cultural nationalisms, but also, I think, for interpretation of this seemingly intractable political problems that come into focus when we start to dissect the mentalities that centuries of institutionalized enslavement helped to create and to consolidate. The longevity of those formations is insufficiently acknowledged. My own reckoning with their deep imprint, is still guided by the radical approach to the historicity of the Atlantic racial order that I discovered as a schoolboy reading the work of W.E.B. Du Bois. And I'm therefore inclined to depart from the views of many, who would describe themselves as zealous anti-racists today. Without appearing complacent or adopting any simplistic understanding of progress, I want to oppose what I take to be the nihilistic conclusion that nothing can ever change in the Leviathan machinery of what is now called anti-blackness. Against the kind of negative theology implicit in that approach, I suggest that the extensive temporal rupture resulting from the Atlantic slave trade necessitates a degree of political literacy and a method of comparative reflection. The peculiar racial order of Atlantic slavery was not eternal, nor was it a hardwired feature of social life or of human constitution. Battles to hasten its passing have been fought for centuries, and there have been multiple attempts to modify our environments in order to dampen or mute those enduring tones, to damp down its continuing reverberations and echoes. Eventually, those traces will fade. And we need to accelerate their demise. And in order to do so, we have to demonstrate continually what will be gained by their overcoming. That is imperative. Du Bois had captured something of this perspective in The Souls of Black Folk, when he identified the question of how it felt to be a problem, how it feels to be a problem, and raised that into a fundamental component of disjuncted black subjectivity, before presenting the colour line as a social and governmental phenomenon that conveyed the geopolitical signature of the 20th century. An assertive figuration of the racial order as a planetary matter was the third element in his transformative vision. And this perspective recurs in a complex commentary on the post-abolition predicament of the formerly enslaved as they embarked in pursuit of freedom and authentic citizenship. It remains valuable, I think, despite the jarringly gendered character with which it was first conjured. Let me quote him. "Amid all crouched the freed slave, bewildered between friend and foe. He had emerged from slavery, not the worst slavery in the world, not a slavery that made all life unbearable, rather a slavery that had here and there something of kindliness, fidelity, and happiness. But with all slavery, which so far as human aspiration and desert were concerned, classed the black man and the ox together." Well, I've employed sonic metaphors, the idea of reverberation, which alerts us to the phenomenological limits of text and textuality. And I've tried to combine it in my remarks with the concept of half-life, so as to identify the difficult circumstances in which a potent and determining presence can continue to be registered, felt, even as it declines. The ambient sounding of the racial order does decay, dying away into a silence that might itself foster new and what I take to be nourishing encounters with the prospect of common humanity and species life. Locally, something of these possibilities can be apprehended in the fitful and uneven retreat of institutional racism, though not yet, of course, its undoing. Limited victories have been won by the political, moral, and pedagogic efforts of anti-racist and anti-colonial movements. Their bold agency, their revolutionary sentiment, and their commitment to what Pumla Gobodo-Madikizela calls empathic repair. Grounded always in the interpretive habits devised and shared by racism's victims. This has extended, I think, across civil society and begun to connect politics, ethics, and policy in configurations that are incompatible with a racially ordered world. And as a result of those hard-won changes, racial hierarchy and the eugenic mentalities that power and partner it can be identified now not as minor errors or incidental aspects of modern sovereignty and capitalist development, but as substantive, even constitutive features of European political culture, of European civilization. The torrid tropical contact zones where we were told history couldn't enter, where spirit wouldn't tread, where what should have been proper works of art remained fixed as puzzling fetish objects, the sort of arbitrary, transient choice of their developmentally arrested manufacturers, now provide an accessible alternative index of Europe's bloody colonial modernization. And that type of criticism of colonial rule has disputed complacent conceptions of humanistic education. The changes that result are not adequately captured by the concept of decolonization, I'd say, but they supply, nonetheless, a measure of the new settlement required by working through this history of Atlantic slavery. And recent pressure to reconfigure institutions, to reimagine the curriculum, even to change the composition of the professoriate and of the student bodies, needs to be considered in the light of that historic possibility. Progress does become more difficult because universities have acquired the corporate world's formula for disinterested diversity and what they imagine to be efficient, friction-free globality. And their widespread efforts in support of what's referred to as EDI are weaker and less plausible when they adopt managerial scripts that demand distance from the disreputable history of opposition to the racial order of things. Efforts that stretch back through previous abolitionist and anti-colonial efforts in Britain and in the formerly colonial territories, places where the metaphysics of racial hierarchy was acted out and acted upon. The problems that prompt institutional change have to be approached historically, even if their historicity is not the full extent of their significance. However, the process of working through the continuing effect of Atlantic slavery should not be left to professional historians. Until recently, their scholastic enthusiasm for getting to grips with the colonial charnel house was extremely limited, especially when contrasted with the work accomplished by several generations of autodidacts and extramural activist writers, people like C.L.R. James, who I've mentioned already, Peter Fryer, Rosina Visram, Marika Sherwood, Ron Ramden, many others, many, many others less well known. Today's anti-racism cannot balk when instructed to retreat by those who fear the results of exposure to enslavement's sublime catalogue of horrors. We are neither so frail nor so innocent that we have to strive to shut out the gory details lest we become triggered or traumatized by them. Again, we're obliged to note that analyzing the kind of political ontology to which the racial order of enslavement gave rise is significant because, as Du Bois' remarks made clear, it foregrounds the question of who's to be considered human or infrahuman and can therefore, on racial grounds, be killed with impunity or consigned legitimately to drudgery as a brute. That line of inquiry was raised initially in the writing produced by fugitive slaves. Frederick Douglass, the most celebrated, contrasts his owner's loving concern for his horses with the cruel contempt he reserved for his human chattels. And Douglas, inspired as much by the writing of Robert Burns as by that of New England Transcendentalism, the Black O'Connell wrote explicitly back to Josiah Nott and George Glyden, who had sought, quoting, to mark the African not only as an inferior race, but as a distinct species, naturally and originally different from the rest of mankind, and as really to place him nearer to the brute than to the man. Those words spring to us from a protracted battle against the condition of being imbruted. And that battle yields a valuable corrective to contemporary radicalism that tends to speak too casually of the more than human, as if the human can be taken for granted as some obvious universal starting point or scientifically calibrated measuring stick, rather than as our distant, our clouded horizon. Du Bois was merely the most notable of many who continued this critique, and it returned in his presentation of the Negro as a tertium quid, a third thing lodged between the human and the animal, in this intermediate position outside the law where vulnerability was maximized. That power to exclude supplied the juridical supplements to race thinking. It catalyzed violent manifestations of the colonial nomos, the belligerent institution, legitimation, and spatialization of the double standard on which all racial orders operate. Here's Du Bois again. The thought of the older South, the sincere and passionate belief that somewhere between men and cattle, God created a tertium quid and called it a Negro, a clownish, simple creature, at times even lovable within its limitations, but straightly foreordained to walk within the veil, unquote. There's a kind of Christian theodicy implied in these observations that reminds us to ponder not just the racialized limits of humanity, but to ask how the attachment to race specified who is recognizable as sibling, as kin, or as neighbor. And there's a subsidiary question here, a subsidiary question of what lessons an ebbing Christian faith might retain from the instructive xenological scenario of the Good Samaritan, if only his status as an alien could be admitted into an analysis that combines an understanding of agape with other issues, such as the incarnation of cultural difference and the operation of the ban, the act of exclusion that is perhaps the original political relation. Well, facing up to the constitutive history of enslavement in the Atlantic now requires more of us than a focus on the way that universities and other corporate bodies address their complicities past and present. And recent efforts to revise understanding of the modern racial imaginary have been compromised when too much respect gets paid to the intellectual microclimates of the scholastic disciplines involved and to the tenaciously policed boundary lines erected between them. I would say that worthwhile critical study of the academic archives that justified racial injustice and inequality can only proceed from a really acute grasp of how the idea of racial hierarchy shaped multiple knowledge projects, how it comprised connective intellectual tissue, how it orchestrated and synchronized diverse bodies of knowledge and made them capable of corresponding to one another, all of them anchored in, beholden to, the distinctive codes of political anatomy and the exigencies of racialized nature and racialized history that specified the menacing figure of the Negro as both less than human and as outside of history. Endowed with anthropological order and the violent momentum of imperial power, nature itself was combined with the advantages conferred by climate and geography in some unprecedented interpretive patterns that spill over, as Londa Schiebinger, Nancy Lee Stepan, among many others, have so notably demonstrated, that spilled over into the ways that gender was becoming legible and intelligible to Europe's modern scientific eye. Identifying those intersections and the analogies to which they give rise has been fundamental to reinvigorating the humanities. However, the genealogies of racialized otherness have not really followed suit. They were separated from the unfolding of gender relations by the ways in which the racial body persistently refused to disclose its secret. Understanding the expansive unfolding of race law that resulted from that refusal is necessary preparation now for analyzing the transformation of knowledge systems that were compromised and corrupted by their reliance on racializing epistemes, and on the metaphysics of white dominance that legitimized Atlantic enslavement and remains a factor in political culture today. Investigating the perils and opportunities that arose from criticism of racial epistemologies associated with enslavement, we discovered that appeals to method were particularly important, made in order to anchor knowledge and relocate certainty amidst the turbulence of early modern globalization, genocidal conquest, and imperial expansion. My old colleague, Peter Hume, suggests that the desire for methods with those capabilities can be read in Cartesian responses to Montaigne's heterological explorations. In particular, his pronouncement of modern European anxieties from the autonomous space he imagined for himself and his inquisitive associates, positioned midway between the Chinese and the Persians to the east and the cannibal savages dwelling in the circum-Atlantic west. For brevity's sake, let's identify the termination of that sequence in Fanon's transgressive observation that the intellectual work involved in understanding the sociogenesis of racial orders arises from the embattled location where methods devour themselves. The beneficiaries of racialized inequality and injustice were sustained by colonial sovereignty, which initiated and maintained the reproduction of racial difference. Enrique Dussel, Argentinian systems theorist and theologian, philosopher, provided some incredible commentaries that explore that terrain and the consequent reconceptualization of time and temporality specified by the violent proceedings in the torrid zone of the planet. And his exacting survey of the relationship between the cogito and the I conquer that preceded it endorses the interpretive course set by Hume and complements the insights of Castoriadis with which I began. It clarifies how triumphalist analysis of European modernity was further distorted by an overly casual approach to questions of historical periodization. I'm sorry. Let me quote Dussel for a moment. The modern ego cogito was anticipated by more than a century by the practical Spanish-Portuguese ego conquero, I conquer, that imposed its will, the first modern will to power, on the indigenous populations of the Americas. The conquest of Mexico thus became the first sphere of the modern ego, unquote. I think these arguments refer us to that difficult psychosocial mechanism I cited earlier, that operates in the colonial space of death. Today, these observations push us towards the challenge of grasping how what Primo Levi called the outrage motive and the profit motive, distinguished from one another in his account, his critical account of the racial order of the Third Reich, how those different things could combine, compete, and conflict in situations overdetermined by distinct kinds of war, law, and technology. There, sovereign power was shaped not only by military priorities, but by a peculiar mix of violence, intimacy, and interdependence that appears wherever a small minority control a much, much larger group with which they have exiled from humanity. Raciology mandates systematic misrecognition while simultaneously promoting the use of infrahuman bodies for plantation labor, sexual gratification, economic gain, and even entertainment. Well, however convenient it might be, I think it's mistaken to think that the immediate beneficiaries of the racial order were alone in their attachment to the idea of race. Their enthusiasm was counterpointed, though never, ever symmetrically mirrored, by the desperate ingenuity of the dominated, the victimized, and the exploited. They borrowed and adapted the oppressive categories originally created to secure their subordination. And those toxins were absorbed into the self-understanding of racism's victims. They would draw upon notions of racial particularity to infuse their suffering with moral meaning and cement their defensive solidarity. Many of them mobilized what they took to be the special connectedness that inhered in raciality in order to orient resistance and pursue a world divested of color-coded distinctions between human and brute, native and savage. So we have to be sensitive to the complementarity of these different appropriations of the race idea and to the unintended consequences of animating racialized anthropology, which can appear clad in the righteous uniform of indigeneity or the modern abolitionist movement or other combative opponents of racial states, as well as among their defenders. It's mistaken to say that because racialized figures have routinely been positioned outside the space in which authentic humanity is found, that the open work of discovering an expanded, revised conception of the human should be renounced. Alternatives to humanity in racialized form have been advocated by opponents of racism who used the struggles against racial order to assemble that visionary counter-humanism. And in the Atlantic setting, the work of Alan Locke, the first African-American Rhodes Scholar here, of Aimé Césaire, of C.L.R. James, I've mentioned, provides numerous variations on that theme, as does the feminist humanisms like those of June Jordan and Sylvia Winter, Jamaican. All of these thinkers arrive at their destinations by anatomizing the absurdity and cruelty of racial hierarchy, instrumentally deployed in political culture. Ambiguity and conflict do persist in the absence of any consensus about whether humanity of these populations descended from enslaved people really does require vindication. Some influential tribunes of contemporary anti-racism insist that their project is ontological, it's not political at all. And those claims encourage them to imagine that racial difference might be retained, it might be kept, it might be cultivated, perhaps as some sort of exotic phenomenon or as a source of enjoyment or awe, just as long as its constitutive links with hierarchy and violence have been destroyed. I'm not sure that's possible. Racial nominalism is a dynamic phenomenon, but that response is not an option in the type of analysis I'm arguing for this evening, because it considers the political ontology of racial groups as an iterated product of raciology rather than as racism's knowable natural source. So these more abstract issues are, in a sense, secondary this evening. Because the idea that there should be a domain of knowledge which can be defined by its opposition to the reification and institutionalization of racial hierarchy is still considered intellectually unserious, if not disreputable. And it's not just that critical race theory, so-called, has been weaponized at the epicenter of cultural wars. Wanting to upend the racial order of the world is dismissed from one side as a form of complicity with superannuated racial categories, while seen from the other as a kind of misguided enterprise that merely exaggerates the routine mechanisms of ideological mystification. So historical and comparative analysis of racial hierarchy is rather more than just another topic within an established field of scholarly inquiry of normal science. And in the absence of that sort of stability, critics of the attachment to race tend to get forced back continually to justify the foundational significance of race thinking, which, as I've said, also generates the structuring or bridging concepts that fostered communication between and across academic disciplines while synchronizing and coordinating their excursions in the exercise of power and judgment, legitimacy and truth, goodness and beauty. The density of those associations means that even the most fervent advocates of the proposition that better knowledge is the best antidote to past racial errors get disoriented and even defensive when faced with requests that the bad faith and the shortcomings involved in the history of racism, for example, in the field of science and medicine, are acknowledged and worked through as a prelude to their repair. The catalogues of error and deceit that comprise the history of racial science are somewhat better known these days, but their association with the brutal governance and symptomatic fantasies in imperial dominion is really far from understood. There's still much, I think, to be gained from focusing on the power of racial ideas, on the power of racial rhetoric and the power to racialize while appreciating the insubstantiality of race, grasping the power that those processes have acquired in proportion to the foundational wrongness that is their essence. Eugenic mentalities persist today, even when the word is unspoken, and scientific racism was not the only variety gifted to us by this history of Atlantic slavery. Well, just briefly, adopting the triangulation pioneered in cultural analysis by Raymond Williams, I would like to say that the culturalist and civilizationist racism that's currently enshrined in aspects of governmental practice should be considered as dominant. It's been absorbed a number of neoliberal pieties, it's fused them with a mode of hyper-individuation that makes cultural variations in experience absolute and unbridgeable, yet presents the structures of racialized inequalities easily surmountable by exceptional individuals. fortified by meritocratic ambition. By contrast, the emergent form of racism is demotic, anxious, resentful, and fearful. It's lost its confidence in the affordances of biological superiority, and it's painfully devoid of cultural competence. And as that anxiety proliferates, the favoured remedy lies not only in the imaginary restoration of departed imperial prestige, but in generic racisms garnered online, mostly, though by no means exclusively, from viral and timeline media. From that digital quarter, emphasis usually falls upon injured whiteness and a resentful victimage orchestrated to project white disadvantage, mostly, though, at the hands of dupes and race traitors rather than of any racial inferiors. You know the chant, "You will not replace us," provides the timely motto for the favourite paramilitary responses here. Judeo-Bolshevism, initially recoded as cultural Marxism, mutates further into perplexing apparitions like Islamo-gauchism. Okay, those conditions of unprecedented technological and political fluidity allow Europe's identitarians to connect easily with North America's alt-right and alt-light. Neo-Nazism can cuddle up to accelerationism, revolutionary conservatism, militant traditionalism, and new variants of political misogyny. Despite their abundant differences, those tendencies share an enthusiasm for the idea of white genocide and the fearful prospect of white extinction, anxieties that echo in every contemporary far-right tendency and repeat Powell's imagery of the catastrophic reversal of slavery's proper shape. Additional transfusions of violent and eugenic energy are provided by discussions of demography and population control, the latter seen increasingly in conjunction with the effects of a climate emergency. You can see that the material legacy of the Codrington family locally is far from the only link between the life of this university and this college and the administration of Britain's imperial dominion. Debate about the after effects of Atlantic slavery and the relationship to racialization of the world has been running locally here for a century and more. And intellectuals of all souls were prominent over many years in public exchanges on that topic, associated conflict over the necessity, morality, and legitimacy of Britain's empire. The practical tasks which are underway, managing the undead traces of that colonial period, is really important, but I'm concerned now with the practical aspects of reparation shouldn't obscure the different kinds of effort involved in coming to terms with enslavement's enduring intellectual and cultural consequences. Tonight, I want to suggest that we consider one or two brief aspects of that unresolved association, which become important to acknowledge when the conflict constituted by the persistent attachment to racial hierarchy is volatile and open to being instrumentalized politically in the patterns I described earlier. And those formations acquire greater gravity in some polities and institutional settings than others. Sometimes, as we've seen, the appeal to racial feeling is overt, sometimes especially where it becomes a matter of culture or civilizational clash rather than absolute biology. The attachment to race may be muted, it may be tacitly inferred, although no less powerful for being underspoken. The family resemblances between racism and ultranationalism can be stronger or weaker, though wherever they appear, they refer us to the inescapable question of how the conceptions of humanity and racial hierarchy derived from the Atlantic history and of plantation societies and enslavement correspond to changing economic and political circumstances. The Trinidadian intellectual Eric Williams engaged early and provocatively in these deliberations, and his celebrated writing built upon ably upon contributions made by earlier African-American commentators and activists, as well as on the work of the Oxford historians who taught him and others further afield, whose view of racial slavery was unencumbered by what he considered as the dead, disabling weight of English scholastic convention. Williams was not only a historian with few peers, but a skilled reader of institutions who understood the strategic fields through which arguments and scholarly publications had to make their way if a sustainable academic career was to be forged. However unpalatable his doctoral research may have been to some of its initial readers hereabouts, its rigour and style were usually acknowledged. And that work is still being read, still being debated, 9 decades after its initial publication. His academic credentials aside, he would go on, as many of you know, to be the political architect of Trinidad's independence from this country. And exploring a world common to Williams and his Oxford tutors, particularly his doctoral examiner, Reginald Coupland, the Bright Professor of Colonial History, author of a 1933 book, The British Anti-Slavery Movement, can just illuminate for a moment some of the larger issues that we need to consider as I move to my conclusion. That turn in Williams' direction is warranted, I think, because since the eruption of Rhodes Must Fall, and most acutely since the American summer of 2020, the watery disposal of the Colston statue and so on, local conversation about the historic demand for Britain's reparative transformation seems to have placed a greater emphasis on how changes should be symbolised rather than how they might be secured. Interest in Williams' work has been revived in that context by discussions of our country's failure to face up to the commercial consequences of enslavement, empire and colony manifested in its heritage estate and its attendant institutional networks. His best known publication, Capitalism and Slavery, is a monograph that derived from his doctoral thesis here. I'm sure many of you know this. And it's foundational in considerations of the ongoing effects of the compensation money paid by government to slaveholders, which he was the first scholar to research in depth. And the book is cited in discussions of country houses, of the sources of industrial capital, of the Atlantic detour and the English route between the glorious revolution of the 17th century and the epiphany of industrial class conflict at the start of the 19th century. And if Williams is remembered as a historian rather than misread as a sort of authenticating avatar for the indictments of humanitarianism that have lately become rather fashionable, it may be for a few sentences in Capitalism and Slavery, where he describes an approach to the long history of Atlantic slavery in which a racial twist was given to what is basically an economic phenomenon. Slavery was not born of racism, he says, in what has become a sort of tweetable fragment or soundbite, somewhat less economistic than I think it initially sounds. Let me continue the quote. Rather, racism was the consequence of slavery, unquote. And in later work, he returned to that question of how moral and economic mechanisms have been aligned. I'm quoting him. The whole problem of the Negro in the United States and everywhere else cannot possibly be viewed except in the light of the whole creaking and groaning world economy. If that problem is solved and the era of peace and prosperity opens up before humankind, that is, the common man, the Negro's progress will be rapid. But if the world continues to indulge in the conflicts that mark the 20th century, the chances are that in increasing antagonism and dislocation, the Negro's claims to equality will be more contested than ever. Of course, Williams narrated his personal conquest of Oxford via the acquisition of an outstanding double first in modern history in 1935, and later through the doctorate that he wrote under the supervision of Vincent Harlow. And he insisted that his institutional ascent had been marred by the inability to secure a fellowship at All Souls, an outcome that he did not hesitate to present as a result of, and these are his words, not mine, racial factors. After that blow, he concluded that the obstacles blocking access to Oxford's elite altitudes were insurmountable. And he recounts his treatment at the hands of the university in startling detail and with perhaps an insightful bitterness in Inward Hunger, his 1969 autobiography, where the clanging absurdity of his failed attempt at merit-based entry into that rarefied environment is described. Let me quote him. I simply did not belong. No native, no matter how detribalized, could fit socially into All Souls. What, for example, could I say in the very midst of the Ethiopian War? In reply to a question as to whether advanced peoples have any right to assume tutelage over backward peoples, if I was ill at ease in the classrooms, I was not at home in the dining rooms. The entire episode convinced me that I would never get an All Souls Fellowship, and that the racial factor would dispose of me in 1936, as the examination factor had done in 1935. Then he was placed, I think, ninth out of 16 candidates. I was very angry, he continues. It was not that I felt I had won the fellowship. I knew I had not, but I knew I could never win one. Unquote. Well, after that clarifying episode, which, according to Caroline Elkin's recent work, unfolded in the middle of Geoffrey Dawson's imperialist interventions in the life of All Souls, Williams fell under the patronage of Alain Locke, the Wagner-loving African-American polymath, aesthete, and recovering Rhodes Scholar. And it was Locke who went on to build an unrivaled career as a philosopher and of social plurality, a literary critic, an editor, a historian of art and music, a translator and linguist, as well as a humane advocate for the exceptional variety of universalistic thinking, a characteristic of the Baha'i faith that he joined in 1918. He'll also be known, those of you in literature will know him perhaps as the midwife to the Harlem Renaissance and the cultural explosion of the new Negro movement. Well, Locke's principal academic accomplishments reside in the field of philosophy, though his political advocacy, in a sense, intervened to delimit the ways in which that work is remembered and evaluated today. And his wide-ranging intellectual life has, I think, been rather narrowly recovered, mostly through his activities as a critic and speculative historian of art. The full impact of those efforts, which reveal him as an early voice in discussions of what we might now consider philosophical approaches to multiculturalism or challenges of planetary citizenship, remains untouched. Locke found the young Trinidadian employment at the historically black Howard University in Washington, D.C., and from there, Williams would return to the independence-seeking West Indies and assume a distinguished political career, initially under the mentorship of C.L.R. James, who had taught him at secondary school before migrating to England to conduct the life of an agitator and cricket journalist a few months after Williams went so hopefully up to Oxford. Cedric Robinson has shown that Williams' decidedly radical understanding of the history of capitalism and the tensions between moral and economic aspects of slavery's abolition provides a really important example of the potency of Atlantic slavery to disrupt and contest 20th century politics of intellectual work on racism, on capitalism, and on humanitarianism. And I would say that problem endures. Williams' intervention can be best understood if we appreciate that the centre of his concerns resides less in the history of slavery and capitalism and much more in a kind of angular commentary on race-friendly humanitarianism and the shortcomings of moral and political agency qualified and corroded by those racial factors of which they were unable to divest themselves. And he made much of his evidence-based approach to these issues, which was contrasted with the fantasies of his tutors in Oxford. Their views, he said, and I'm quoting again, not only involved drawing large conclusions from no evidence at all, unquote, but, quote, proceeded to draw still larger conclusions for imperialism in the 20th century from its unsupported large conclusions about imperialism in the 19th century, unquote. He emphasized that capitalism and slavery had deliberately subordinated the inhumanity of the slave system and the humanitarianism that destroyed that system. But he cautioned that to disregard those aspects completely would be to commit a grave historical error and to ignore one of the greatest propaganda movements of all time. The humanitarians were, he said, the spearhead of the onslaught which destroyed the West India system and freed the Negro, unquote. The importance of the humanitarians, he emphasized, and I'm quoting again, has been seriously misunderstood and grossly exaggerated by men who sacrifice scholarship to sentimentality, and like the scholastics of old, placed faith before reason and evidence. Professor Coupland, in an imaginary interview with Wilberforce, asked him, quote, who do you think, sir, is the primary significance? What do you think, sir, is the primary significance of your work? The lesson of the abolition of the slave system? And the answer instantly is, it was God's work. It signifies the triumph of his will over human selfishness. It teaches that no obstacle of interest or prejudice is irremovable by faith and prayer, unquote. While I think mapping the deficiencies in the outlook of humanitarians in relation to the conventional shortcomings of English historiography, by doing that, Williams initiates a new approach to the history of overcoming the racial hierarchy created and maintained by systematic enslavement. And of course, he's also notable for writing at length on the intellectual cleavage in the Victorian intelligentsia that had been produced by the cataclysmic rebellion in Morant Bay in 1865. Today, following in his footsteps means seeing how the loftiest ideals can be tempered by economic interest. And understanding how historiography has been distorted by the wishful thinking of liberal commentators who were disoriented and deeply shamed by slaving and the injustices perpetrated by English colonial government. From that encounter, contemporary students can expect to learn the value of a hermeneutics of suspicion when it comes to the universal claims of humanisms that derive ethnocentrically from the flaws of Latin Christendom. They learn, too, that we must return urgently to the problem of how what we study corresponds to what we are, always in relation to others. And that, as Sylvia Winter has emphasized over the years, we should revisit the problem of the human after the death of the idea of man, created by 18th century anthropology. Those inquiries proceed through a protracted confrontation with the race-friendly architecture of metaphysical dualism, a path that shows not only humans were reduced to objects and brutes, but also confirms that the history of racism is, in large measure, the institutional production of infrahumanity. If we're lucky, exploring enslavement's archives of cruelty may also teach us to invest in patience, in attentiveness, in proportionality, in perspective, and to bring a certain humour to these tasks, to acquire the capacity to see and appreciate lines of connection that defy the vocabularies and rhetorics of race as a matter of political ontology. These are among the most important of the habits we'll need to cultivate if we're to break those cycles of fear, anxiety, and hatred on which racism thrives. Direct, detailed denunciation of the errors and evils of racism does have its place, but we cannot indefinitely defer the moment when anti-racists become sufficiently confident of the direction in which they feel things should move. Critique alone is insufficient. Coming to terms with the vital history of Atlantic slavery is the best, though not the only, available resource from which that belated operation can proceed. Thank you very much.
To conclude, can I first thank you all very much indeed for coming to this lecture. It's been, I think, a very important occasion at which we have all been present for at least two reasons. First, it was an absolutely terrific lecture, a very important lecture, giving us a very great deal to think about. And the second reason is it is an inaugural lecture, so this will be an annual series. And I cannot imagine a better start to that than what we have heard this evening. So, Paul, we are all, and the college, on behalf of the whole college, let me underline this, immensely grateful to you. Thank you very much indeed.